When most Bible students look at the Herods, they think about that kind of in an isolated scene. We see baby Jesus in Bethlehem being targeted by a Herod. We see John the Baptizer being imprisoned and ultimately beheaded by a Herod. We see Paul the Apostle standing before a Herod, and this Herod confessing, "Almost thou can." Convinces me to be a Christian or persuades me to be a Christian. What's also often misleading is we kind of see those characters in their isolated context, and we don't have an application of who they are, where they come from. And certainly we could understand some about the history of the Herods from the Bible, but having that, as Terrence alluded to, that extant or existing information helps us draw better conclusions. We saw that with the Babylonian Empire and part of the Greek Empire. We saw that with the Roman Empire and how Michael dealt with that. The Greeks, we dealt with those as well. And so this morning, we focus our attention on the Herods. Who are the Herods? Where did they come from? Don't end your sentences and prepositions, English guys. From where did they come? I want us to keep in mind that these men, these leaders, are the political backdrop of the New Testament. The Hasmoneans were during the end of the Greek occupation of the Palestinian area, the area is Palestine, Judea, and that area. These are the ruling class of the priesthood. They're called the Hasmoneans. This is a high priest slash king situation. So the Hasmonean dynasty, a man named John Hyrcanus, I pronounce it. I don't know how you pronounce it. That's how I pronounce it. He defeated a group of people called the Idumeans. Now, the Idumeans are the root of this dynasty of the Herods. You can see this hastily scrawled map that I did just a moment ago, and I want us to look all the way back in Genesis chapter 36. Genesis 36, verse number 1. Now, these are the generations of Esau. Notice this carefully. Who is Edom, E-D-O-M. Now, fast forward to Numbers chapter 20. I know you're turning very rapidly, but Numbers chapter 20, you recall that as Egypt led Moses, the Israelites flee from Egypt, go down to Mount Sinai, receive Exodus chapter 20, the law of Moses, and then they begin to venture up to the promised land. They make their way all the way to Kadesh Barnea, and the 12 spies enter. 40 days, they reject. God punishes them. 40 years, you've got to wander in the desert. They make their way over to the south of the Dead Sea, this southern Transjordan Valley, and they appeal to the king of Edom. We want to pass through your land. And he says, no. Edomites. They have to traverse go all the way down to, the scripture says, the Red Sea. We would know this as the Gulf of Aqaba, geology or our geography class. And then they traverse, go all the way back up and go into Moab. Then from Moab, Moses dies, Joshua conquest. Balance of Israel's history. Between the testaments at the end of Malachi and before Matthew, here in this region, these Edomites suddenly are called the Idumeans. Idumeans are a name that the Greeks ascribe to them. Not a different group of people, that's just simply how the Greeks called them. We say Greeks, we call them Greeks, they would balk at that. We are Hellenes. The Hellenists called them Idumeans. So the Edomites become Idumeans and they dominate this area. What we said a moment ago, John Hyrcanus, he defeated them and compelled them to become Jews, to become proselyte Jews. We want all your men to be circumcised. We want you to follow fully the law of Moses. We want you to convert to the Hebrew religion. We kind of get lost in that as well. It's not Judaism proper. It's the Hebrew religion. They had morphed it, changed it. That's not my class. That's not my lesson. So the prophets throughout history, this region of Edom, the prophets continually condemned the Edomites. Obadiah dedicated, or God through the prophet Obadiah, dedicated the entire book of prophecy to their coming judgment. Maybe you've seen, anyone seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, the last one? What was it, where they're looking for the cup? What was that one? The Last Crusade, that's it. The Last Crusade. You know that temple that they go into? I believe Brother Tom has been there. Petra. You go in there. Well, this is where this is, down in this area. Tom says you can't go in there. It doesn't go very deep in there, just, 10 or 12 feet or something like that. So this is this people. Obadiah mentions that you have yourself perched up above in your stronghold, and God is going to bring you down. By the second century BC, political landscape was changing very rapidly. And as we said, John Hyrcanus conquered Idumea around 125 BC. And so, again, as we noticed, Josephus records the fact that they were compelled to convert to these Jewish customs and receive circumcision, etc. And this decision had very profound consequences. The Herods, we see then, they were Jews by religion, but not by descent, not by ancestry. They had no lineage in the Hebrew. They weren't true sons of Abraham, although they shared a common lineage. They were Edomites. They were descendants of Lot and others. So to many of the Hebrews living during that period of time, the Jews in Judea, these Herodians, these Edomites, these Idumeans, they were concerned with this covenant identity. And so there's a distinction there, and it mattered to them. The Herods could never claim Davidic lineage, and that is to say that this kingship, according to these Judeans, was never legitimate because it did not come through the house of David. Now, we understand Jeremiah 22 and verse number 30. There's a prophecy of a man named Jeconiah or Coniah, stating very plainly that no descendant of David from thenceforth would ever sit upon the throne of David in Jerusalem, ever. That kind of blows out of the water these premillennialists that demand that Jesus Christ is going to come back to this earth and set up an earthly reign for 1,000 years, and he himself is going to reign in Jerusalem on the throne of David. Through whom did David spring? From Judah and from the line of David, or rather Jesus through the line of David. Can happen. Make God a liar. God cannot lie. Again, a different lesson for a different time. This authority that the Herods had would always rest upon a political power rather than this covenant legitimacy. And this explains much which follows. I want you to notice a man named Antipater. I don't know how you pronounce it. That's how I pronounce it. I don't know how you pronounce it, but that's how I pronounce it. He was the founder of the Herodian power. This man was born about 113 B.C., 113, 114. We don't really know. Our calendars aren't quite the same. Things don't line up quite the same as they do for us. But this man, Antipater, he's the true founder of this Herodian dynasty. He was an Idumean. He possessed an extraordinary gift for, can we say, political survival. At this point in history, when he gets somewhere around 40 or 50 years old, in the late Hasmonean period, there was some infighting between Hyrcanus II and a man named Aristobulus II. I don't know how you pronounce that. That's how I pronounce it. I don't know how you pronounce it, Brother Skaggs. Both of these men claim legitimacy, and so they were at odds. There's almost another civil war in Judea. And so Antipater, he aligns himself with Hyrcanus. Why? Because Hyrcanus was a very weak ruler, weak man. A weak ruler needs strong advisors, and he was weak. Antipater seized this opportunity and became that advisor to the throne there, and soon he effectively controlled Judean politics from behind the scene. And there's some more infighting, and ultimately almost another civil war. Here comes Pompey the Great, a Roman general. He's sweeping through. He's dealt with the remnants of this northern Hellenistic Greek Empire, and he's claiming all of these regions for Rome. He comes into Judea and puts this to rest, puts this civil war, this Hasmonean civil war to rest. This is in 63 BC. And Pompey the Great conquers Jerusalem. And in fact, he goes into the temple. And he even enters into the holy place and opens the Holy of Holies and sees what's in there. And certainly that, to any self-respecting Jewish person, this was an affront to everything that the Israelites stood for. But he didn't sack the temple. He was talked out of that, said, these people can prove to be beneficial to us. Just let them live in peace, and we can maybe build an alliance with these folks. And so the age of Jewish independence was very rapidly leaving their grasp. Rome had arrived. Jewish leaders, of course, viewed Rome as a threat and as a temporary problem. Antipater, however, viewed Rome as the future. A lot of good, I'd say good, a lot of savvy business people can see when it's time to strike and when it's time to hold back. And Brother Jason, man, Antipater saw the Romans as an opportunity to advance his legacy, his lineage. And so he allies himself with the Roman powers here, and this insight makes him an indispensable part of history. And so while Julius Caesar and Pompey later begin to fight for control of the Roman world, in 47 BC, Antipater sides with Julius Caesar and fights with him against Pompey. And so after Caesar's victory, Antipater receives full Roman citizenship and substantial authority in the region of Judea. Again, remember, this man, his descendants, or his ancestors rather, are from Edom. They're not from Judea yet. He is in control. He is over a great deal of the region of Judea. His family now stood close to power, closer than any Idumean had ever had. And his sons, he had two sons, Phaziel and Herod. Phaziel and Herod. And each of them received two important appointments. Jerusalem and the region around Judea goes to Phariseo. And or Phaziel, rather. And Herod, he receives this region up in Galilee. Antipater was assassinated by a rival about 43 B.C. named Malchus. He was poisoned to death. And so the stage here is set. Usher in Herod the Great. Now, Herod, he's ruling in Galilee. That's up here close to the Sea of Galilee, this being the Dead Sea. And this, of course, this region of northern, when the kingdom of Israel and Judah separated, the northern kingdom of Israel, this would be the upper part of that. This is where Jesus and his 12 apostles would be from this region. But usher in Herod the Great. This is Rome's ideal client king, and no figure dominated this period more than Herod, and we're going to call him Herod the Great. I love what my good friend Michael Lye, by the way, he threw me under the bus the other day when I wasn't here. It was my wife's 32nd anniversary, and I was compelled to not be here, and from this place right here, he threw me under the bus and said I wasn't here, and I missed him. Nonetheless, I digress. Herod the Great, he's called the Great, and again, as Michael Light would say, no one is called the Great unless they do something great. Alexander from Macedonia became Alexander the Great when he started doing things that Alexander the Great did. Catherine the Great, the leader of Russia, she became great when she did the things that Catherine the Great did. Pompey the Great, Pompeius Magnus became great when he did all the conquests that he did. Well, now we have Herod the Great. He's going to be called great for a specific set of reasons from the Roman aspect, but to many people, he's not going to be so great after all. Josephus devotes an enormous amount of attention to him, and for good reason. And again, if you are an avid reader, and Josephus is a little tough to get through, but if you enjoy reading, especially history, I would invite you to read from Josephus, if not from some commentary that deal with Josephus's works. So Herod was one of the most capable political rulers ever in the ancient world, and that's important. This man was as savvy as his father was. He knew when the iron was hot, he knew when to strike. He was also one of the most dangerous. We may even call him today unhinged. This man was nearly legitimately insane with power, drunk with power. There's a Parthian invasion. The Parthians are the Persians, the remnant of the Persians. They invade Judea in the year 40 B.C., and it nearly destroyed his career. His brother Phaziel was captured, put in a Parthian prison. They announced their intentions to him that they're going to mutilate him publicly until he is dead before a group of people. And so, according to legend, he decides to end his own life and several times bashes his head into a stone in that prison wall to keep from having to suffer that fate. Herod, on the other hand, sees what's going on and he flees. He flees to Rome. While in Rome, he appeals to those in power, and he accomplishes something very remarkable. Mark Antony, Octavian Caesar, later will be Augustus, and a man named Lepidus. And again, this isn't a Roman history class, but a very important period of time here. This is shortly after the assassination of Julius Caesar, who had been named to be the dictator, that is the sole ruler during a period of unrest in the kingdom, the empire rather. And these, after that, these, typically Rome had a biumvirate, that is two rulers who had to agree on everything or what they were tasked with wouldn't take place. Well, during this period of time, there's the second, what we would call the triumvirate. Not triumphant as in entering in the city, but three people in charge. That is Octavius, Mark Antony, and a man named Lepidus. Lepidus was kind of washed out of history because he wasn't that significant. But ultimately, Mark Antony and Octavian, they persuade the Roman Senate to declare Herod king of the Jews. Again, imagine. Now, they've been sort of a client king with Rome, but their legitimacy here in this region never has been truly solidified until now. Now Herod the Great is king of all Judea. Not just all Judea, but everything that encompassed Judea, all the way up into Galilee, over into Tracia, in this region, Idumea, and others. And so his expanse was very vast. And so this title deserves some reflection. He's king of the Jews here, a descendant of Esau, had been declared king of the Jews by a pagan kingdom. Interesting. Fullness of time, God set forth his Son. We can see things working, moving their way for Jesus to be born in the world. By 37 B.C., Jerusalem belonged to him. And Rome absolutely loved Herod. Rome valued stability over everything else, and Herod represented stability in the region. He suppressed rebellions. He secured trade routes. He collected tax efficiently and effectively. He remained loyal. Even though there was political turmoil in Rome, he remained loyal to Rome. And one of his greatest achievements was surviving the transition from Mark Antony to Caesar Augustus. And so Antony lost at Actium, a very important battle in Roman history in 31 B.C., and many of his allies were destroyed. One of the allies of Mark Antony was Herod. And so Herod goes to Octavian and says, "Now listen, I'm going to tell you the truth. I was on Mark Antony's side. But let me convince you why you're going to see that as a good thing. I was loyal to him, to maybe even to a fault, but I want you to understand that my loyalty to him can now be transferred to you because you're the victor, and I'll be just as loyal to you, maybe even more. You'd rather have me as a friend than put me to death." And you know, this impresses Octavian, and he says, "You know what? I think you're right. You've done a good job down here in Judea. Let's do this. Let's allow my..." Octavian is the first emperor, Julius Caesar is not, of Rome. The first emperor recognizes his legitimacy and says, "Well, I'm going to give you the full power of Rome. I'm going to put the full power of Rome behind you, support you." Notice this, brethren, as a client kingdom, not as a region, not as a Roman province, but a client kingdom. You're going to be an independent state that works alongside Rome. You help us, we'll help you, and we'll work this out together. And that's the way they function. The relationship that they had flourished. But many Jews distrusted him, as they well should have. His accomplishments didn't translate into popularity. He represented a foreign domination. He built theaters, amphitheaters, and pagan here in Jerusalem. Now, this is perhaps one of the greatest things he's known for is his building projects. One of his buddies in the Roman world was was a man who was apt at building. He was a general for Octavius, and his name was Marcus Agrippa. And in fact, they were so close that he would name his couple of his children after him. We know that the rebuilding of the temple complex, that Herod the Great is known for this. Just an anecdotal portion of his commitment to architecture and building. If you go over to the remnants of the Western Wall today, and you're able to have unfettered access and go into one of those tunnels, you'll see something called the Great Stone. And that Great Stone is 44, a little over 44 and a half feet long, a little over 11 feet tall, and probably that deep. I haven't dug it out. I don't know how deep it is. It's anywhere from 11 to 15, maybe as much as 26, 27 feet deep. The other day I got my iPhone and, you know, it has that measurement thing. How far is that? Well, I measured from that wall right over there, and I started walking. And I made my way all the way to this crease. That is 44 feet. And I stood right here a little bit this way, and that is about 15 feet deep. And 11 feet, if you look at this course of windows, if you go to the very top of that and come down about 12 to 18 inches, that's how big that stone is. That stone that Herod the Great had moved in place served a couple of purposes. It actually serves as a stabilizer to the entire foundation. This place is prone to earthquakes and things of this nature, and whether by his own design or some of his designers, they designed that where if an earthquake shook this foundation, the temple platform would not shake. This one stone would absorb all of that energy, most of that energy. Interesting. He's a very accomplished builder. Yet the Jews detested him. He built Caesarea Maritima. We know of a couple of Caesareas. That's the Caesarea that's up here, where Paul would flee from Jerusalem with a company of soldiers after his capture in the temple. There's a Caesarea Philippi up in this region, but he built Caesarea Maritima. As we move on, we notice that Herod had some other things that did not make him quite so popular. Herod and the high priesthood. He took the position of high priest and made it a political one. He established appointments and removed the high priest by the king for political reasons. He eliminated the hereditary claim to the office, violating Exodus 29 in verse number 29. He kept the priestly vestments, that is the gold breastplate and things of this nature, he kept them in the citadel, not in the temple itself. Six high priests served during the reign of Herod the Great. Aniel, Aristobulus the Third, Aniel again, Jesus, the son of Phibi, Simon, the son of Bethos, Matthias, the son of Theophilus. You see these Greek-sounding names, these Hellenistic-sounding names. Joazar, the son of Bethos. The fact that he changed the priesthood is kind of telling of his grasp of power. Ever wondered why there are two high priests mentioned during the time of Jesus during his trial? There's Annas and Caiaphas, and Annas seems to have at least some reverence among the people, if we can use that term, but Caiaphas seems to be the one in charge. That's the son-in-law and the father-in-law. That's because of Herod's doing. I want us to, I've got 16 pages of notes, so I don't want to, I've got 10 minutes left. Then we see the Sadducees and the Herodian Alliance. There's the Sadducees, and we understand the denominationalism that occurred. Denominationalism isn't a Christian invention. Denominationalism was existent during the time of these the Hebrew religion. Sadducees, Pharisees, Herodians, Essenes, Zealots, others. The Sadducees were allied with Herod because, well, it's political. The Sadducees largely came from priestly and the circles of aristocracy, and so their influence depended upon the temple. We get paid when the temple gets paid, and you can see how that stability that depended upon Rome was kind of through the hands of Herod, and so he served as intermediaries. Again, we'll skip all that. Let's get to his sons in the time that we have left, and that's what we're heading for here. The Herod's sons, he died. Herod the Great died in 4 BC. He had four sons. Actually, he had six sons. Rather than the kingdom falling to his oldest son, Rome said, well, these boys cannot do the job that Herod the Great could do, so we're no longer going to allow Judea to be a client kingdom. We're going to fragment it. We're going to break it up, and all of these regions will become provinces. We're going to appoint Roman governors to oversee, but allow these kings to sort of rule, but it's going to be a puppet regime because these boys don't know what they're doing. They're not like Herod the Great. Enter into men like Pontius Pilate, Felix, and others. So these sons of his, Antipas, he received Galilee and Perea. Archelaus received Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. He was very incompetent, and very soon in 6 AD, Augustus deposed him. Antipas is the one that governed during virtually the entire ministry of Jesus. He's the one that imprisoned John the Baptist, executed John, questioned Jesus. Luke 13:32, Jesus calls him that fox. Philip governed the northeast territory. This is, he had a wife that the other Herod took as a bride. Philip was the most capable and up in the northeast. So Agrippa the First, his father was Aristobulus, his mother, Herod's second wife, Merame. She was part of the Hasmonean dynasty. Remember back that we were talking about them? Herod had him and his brother Alexander strangled to death because the people liked them a lot. Now Herod was not a good man whatsoever. The running joke among the Hellenistic world was, you know, that Herod out there in Judea, I'd rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son. Knowing that he claimed to be a Jew and wouldn't touch a pig, he strangled his own sons. Eventually, Agrippa the First, his grandson of Herod the Great, cultivated a strong relationship with Roman emperors, and he eventually controlled a territory resembling that of his grandfather, but not fully. And Acts 12 records his persecution of the church. He's the one that executed James, imprisoned Peter, and later persecuted Christians to please influential elements in Judea. Acts 12, we read of his demise, teaching the younger guys in Bible class. This is always one of their favorite stories. He's eaten with worms and died. They love to hear that. Agrippa II, the last Herod. He appears in Acts 25 and 26 during Paul's imprisonment. And again, unlike many of the Jewish leaders, he understands Rome's military powers. And as rebellion came on the scene, he starts trying to convince people, listen, we don't need to be a part of this. And his famous exchange with Paul would become the last major appearance of anyone in the Herodian dynasty, leading ultimately to them being surrounded, Jerusalem being surrounded in 66 AD by Vespasian and Titus. And then ultimately in 70 AD, the entire city of Jerusalem being destroyed. So we see political frustration, economic instability, religious division, national fervor, corrupt administrations, and factionalism, all contributing to the downfall. That is, as John wrote, I see the axe being laid to the root of the tree, Jerusalem being destroyed by a king who was not a Hebrew, appointed by a nation full of pagans, and these people in Judea trying to placate all of them. Thus, in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son. You and I might enjoy salvation.